Once again, it is my privilege to be joined by John Loftus, the co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press in 1994. Mr. Loftus's co-author is Mark Ahrens. The book is subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. John, before the break, we were talking about the fascist connections of the Duke of Windsor and the embarrassment that this caused to the British family, and also the problem that presented to British intelligence, both during the war and after World War II. There was a considerable amount of footage shown on the in the electronic media of the British royal family presiding over the 50th anniversary of VE Day, or the British Observations of Same. One of the factors that looms very large in yours and Mr. Ahrens' book is the input of people within the intelligence community, including a group of veteran intelligencers who agreed to participate in yours and Mr. Ahrens' effort on condition of anonymity. You refer to them as the old spies. Could you perhaps just tell us a little bit about them?
These were people principally retired from the U.S. and British intelligence communities who wanted to tell their story of what really happened. But to do so, they had to do it under the condition of legal anonymity and with knowledge that as an attorney-client, I would keep their names confidential, and that in turn, because of my role in working for the Attorney General, they knew that everything I would write would have to be cleared through CIA publication review. So I was a safe person for them to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And their general thrust is that intelligence is the most valuable commodity in the world, and that there was an interlocking relationship between the intelligence agencies and certain of the corporate powers, principally the oil companies, that the links that were made with the original investments in Germany after the war led to a desperate attempt by the people intelligence community to cover some of their corporate bosses. They were trying, for example, to assassinate Hitler and put together an alliance between Germany and England against Russia. That failed to come off when the bomb attempt against Hitler failed to take place. And then after the war, their principal concern was to get their money out without anyone finding out in America or England that these were the people that had helped finance the German war machine in the first place.
The old spies have made an invaluable contribution, and perhaps at the risk of seeming a little corny, at the end, I'd like to pay tribute, at the end of our interview, I'd like to pay tribute to them. John, you mentioned, and perhaps this is a point we've already covered in sufficient depth, but you mentioned that the fascist connections of the Duke of Windsor and his fascist sympathies mm-hmm. actually was of considerable embarrassment to British intelligence and actually affected British intelligence for many years after World War II.
Yeah. British intelligence ran around trying to cover up not just Windsor's Nazi connection, but several, unfortunately, prominent right-wing people in Britain had also been involved with some of the Nazi deals and shenanigans. Now, the people in British intelligence who ran the cover-up were, unfortunately, largely communist agents. People today may not recall the name of Kim Philby and some of his cohorts, like the Hunts and the rest, but they were the people who were entrusted with the job of burying this most awful scandal, that they actually had members of the royal family who were on the wrong side of World War II, not to mention a bunch of British businessmen who would have to be in the dock if Windsor ever went on trial. So those communist agents who inside Britain who posed as right-wing neo-fascists had the perfect cover. And even after their treason was discovered, they could not be prosecuted because of what they knew about the cover-up of the royal family and the British investors. By and large, they were given immunity or simply allowed to escape to Russia.
The world of what Mad Magazine used to refer to as spy versus spy is a very Byzantine and tortuous one. It's one that I generally try to stay away from in my broadcast simply because it is such a complex situation. And as your book makes quite clear, frequently major intelligence agencies themselves are deceived not only by their enemies, but sometimes by their alleged friends.
Oh, my favorite example of that, and we discuss it in the book, is Hitler's secret spy network against Russia, codenamed Max. It was the top secret. They actually had a network of white Russian anti-communists and fascist Jews who every day were delivering to Hitler's generals the top secret mobilization plans of the Red Army incredibly detailed reports on every move that Stalin was making. So this network, the Max network, even though they were Jews, was protected by the top general staff of the Third Reich. Even after Hitler ordered all the Jews be fired from jobs, these guys stayed on. And what they didn't know, though, was that all through the war, the Max network weren't fascist Jews. They were communist Jews. They were working for the Russian allies. And the information they were giving Hitler's generals was 99% accurate, except for the occasional day when they went silent. And those were the days we had things like the Battle of Kursk or the Battle of Stalingrad, where the German army suffered their largest defeats. It's probably not hyperbole to say that this intelligence unit, the Max network, was responsible for the Allied victory on the Eastern Front. They literally helped destroy 70% of the Nazi divisions. It was one of the most incredible con games ever perpetrated. And right through the end of the war, the German generals had no idea that they had been taken in so successfully.
Perhaps this would be a case of what Winston Churchill referred to in connection with the RAF and the Battle of Britain, of never have so many owed so much to so few.
Oh, absolutely. It's this small group of Jews actually turned the tide of war in Eastern Europe.
To many of the anti-Semites and fascists that figure in your book, that must have, when it became public after many years, that must have served as confirmation of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories of which they were so fond.
Unfortunately, though, that doesn't fly, because these Jews were neither fascist Jews nor communist Jews. They were Zionists.
Oh, absolutely.
And they were pro-American.
Yeah.
The first thing we did when the war was over was to blow the whistle on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, guys like Alan Dulles by then had wormed their way back into U.S. intelligence. And they didn't believe it, or didn't want to believe it. Believe it or not, Alan Dulles actually hired the remnants of the Max network for the CIA during their Cold War operations against Russia.
Sure, sure.
So you can imagine what a hideous embarrassment that was for the agency.
Absolutely. I was not indicating that they were, in fact, Zionist conspirators, but I can picture some of these fascists upon learning of that and saying, you know, you see, we told you, you can't trust the Jews. They're everywhere, and they lurk behind every bush, and there's a pun there.
Yeah.
One of the intelligence scams that you get into in your book, and one which, like so many of the others, had ramifications for literally decades, stretching right on up into George Bush's tenure as Director of Central Intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and that is the Vessel scandal, a truly Byzantine intelligence, counterintelligence machination, which I found reading it. I'm a pretty good reader, and I'm a veteran of this type of research, but I had to make diagrams to follow the players.
It was really cute. I'll try and simplify it. What happened is, a group of American fascists, headed by Hugh Angleton, the father of Jim Angleton, volunteered for intelligence service in Rome after World War II because they were working, unfortunately, with the Vatican to rescue a lot of the Nazi money that was coming out. And in order to con President Roosevelt and later President Truman into adopting, into changing their policies, Angleton actually forged Vatican cables. They were codenamed Vessel. And they were delivered right to the President of the United States. And this supposedly was the most secret intelligence from inside the Vatican.
Now, this was James Jesus Angleton.
Right.
And his father, Hugh, was a fascist sympathizer who was working with National Cash Register.
Oh, yeah, that was before the war.
Right, before the war.
Yeah, and then during the war, he was setting up an intelligence network. We still can't tell which side it was on. But after the war, Hugh Angleton was in Rome trying to rescue the remnants of the business investors of the Third Reich, and largely succeeded.
The Vessel scam continued to echo through the corridors of U.S. intelligence for a long period of time after World War II. And in fact, one of the things you discuss in your book is that as it became clear, finally, in the 1970s, what had been going on, there appears to have been some tampering with the Vessel files, and that this occurred on George Bush's watch as Director of Central Intelligence.
What happened is when the new Freedom of Information Act was passed, a Vatican historian, Father Graham, asked for copies of the Vessel files because he thought it was just referred to a minor incident in intelligence history. Well, the CIA was thrown into an uproar. The Vatican saw these cables. They would know at once that they were phony. So they called Jim Angleton from retirement and had him go through and censor and shred most of the cables. And you can actually see on the original documents where Angleton put a black magic marker through the cable references that would look as if they were not cables at all, but simply paraphrases of conversations. So Angleton went to work in the shredding, and still only a little bit of the documents were released to the Vatican. But Father Graham immediately recognized that this was part of a larger forgery context, so he didn't know the whole story. I was fortunate in that one of the retired spies, a guy by the name of Bill Gowan, who lives in New York City and decided to go public to help with this, was able to go back and compare some of the original Italian court records with the CIA files that I obtained, and we discovered they were, in fact, complete forgeries. And the CIA did their own investigation, confirmed it, and informed the National Archives that they'd have to put a clear warning label on these stack of files. It was amazing. But the bottom line is, here were American intelligence officers passing forged information to the President of the United States, not to mention the other U.S. intelligence agencies.
I think it serves to underscore once again, as does so much of your book, the importance of the world of espionage and intelligence within the framework of power politics. Unfortunately, when one deals in an academic sense with the intelligence community, one is dismissed as conspiracy theorist or worse. And frankly, I have worn that scarlet letter with all of the personal and professional consequences that entails. And yet, although there's certainly a lot of that research that is shabby or nutty, and there are plenty of loose cannons in this field, it is a terribly important area of study. And I think much of our understanding of history has been impaired by the failure of political scientists and historians to come to terms with what you and your co-author, courtesy of the old spies as well as your own formidable academic research, have come to terms with it, and it's one of the strong points of your book.
Yeah, I think that one-third of modern history is classified. It's buried down in those archives. And now, bit by bit, they're being declassified, and we have to rewrite our previous concept of history. There's another author, Chris Simpson, who did a wonderful book on Dulles and the early banking things, and citing directly to recently released State Department correspondence files.
I believe that's called The Splendid Blonde Beast.
Yeah.
And he also did a wonderful book, although you and your co-author take issue with some of the vessel material as it related to this book, and that is the book Blowback. Both books, by the way, familiar. Both books familiar to my audience. Also, one thing I was very pleased about when I read The Secret War Against the Jews is that you paid kudos to another book that I think is a remarkable effort, also a very recent book, and a book which was simply ignored, and that is The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch.
Yeah, any book like Simpson's or Burton Hirsch's or Charles Higham's that talks about corporate links and the intelligence links either does not get reviewed in the New York Times or gets bashed. Simpson's book, my book, will never get reviewed.
It's one of the reasons why I'm doing this interview. I think you have written as important a book as I can recall reading, and I think it's a book which people across this country and around the world and across the political spectrum, frankly, from progressive to conservative, should read and take very seriously.
We're not taking any political bias here. We're simply telling the truth. This is what happened. Our only agenda is to tell the truth, let the chips fall where they may. I'm Irish Catholic. I have no agenda one way or the other. This is simply a history, an oral history of these guys that really happened in our century, and there's an enormous amount of documentary evidence to back it up.
Amen. There's an old Turkish proverb, by the way, he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages.
I just wanted to be the first whistleblower in America to break even.
Or perhaps, at the very least, he who did updating it to the contemporary journalistic framework, he who tells the truth does not get reviewed by the New York Times Book Review.
Yeah. I had a hilarious call from people in the intelligence community saying, you know, there's a real whispering campaign going about the book, tell people not to review it. And sure enough, then our book was front page in Britain and Israel, Australia. Not here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't surprise me.
It's a bit too embarrassing.
Yeah, well, it is, and
we've named the airport in Washington the Dulles Airport.
Indeed.
After a guy whom Supreme Court Justice Goldberg said was an American traitor.
Yeah, and of course, he was CIA director when his brother John Foster, a partner in these treasonous machinations, was Secretary of State.
Oh, yeah.
Something that we were speaking about the intelligence scandals that the book discusses, and the role of blackmail as it applies to international power politics. In the first part of our interview, we were discussing the collusion, treasonous in many cases, between key American industrialists and financiers and the fascist powers of Europe, chiefly the Third Reich. We were discussing the Rockefeller family and their channeling of oil to the Third Reich, not only before World War II, but during World War II as well. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you get into in The Secret War Against the Jews is the subterranean power politics, or the behind-the-scenes power politics with regard to the creation of the State of Israel. Something
sure.
that was viewed...
Don't you think it's sort of curious that Ben-Gurion was able to get two-thirds of the nations in the UN to vote for the creation of Israel? I mean, even the anti-Semitic states. They did it with blackmail. And Rockefeller was a key guy involved in that. 3 days before the vote for the partition of Palestine, the Zionists realized there'd be several votes short of the two-thirds majority. So a Zionist delegate went to see Nelson Rockefeller and dumped all the evidence on his desk of Rockefeller's giving aid and comfort to the enemy during wartime. And the Jews offered to trade silence in return for votes. In 3 days, Nelson Rockefeller turned around every nation in Latin America. They all either voted in favor of Israel or abstained, which was just as important to reach the two-thirds majority.
So that basically, the Rockefeller collusion with the Third Reich was used as leverage to obtain the necessary votes in the United Nations.
Yeah.
Much of the opposition to the creation of the State of Israel within the United States came from this same transatlantic industrial and financial axis. People
oh,
like
surely. James Forrestal.
That took the words right out of my mouth.
Yep.
Go ahead.
He was Secretary of Defense. He was also one of the directors of Brown Brothers Harriman. That was one of the companies that invested in the Nazis.
Was he involved with Dylan Reed as well?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. I think he was the vice president of Dylan Reed.
Okay.
Ostensibly a Democrat, but his loyalties really lay more with the corporate powers. And they were the people who wanted to make the Middle East safe for Hitler during the war. And then after the war, really wanted to get Arab oil. And, you know, the Jews were just seen as an obstacle, a hindrance. Just as we ignored all the intelligence information that poured in about the Holocaust, and we made the Jews expendable during World War II, we were perfectly willing to make Israel expendable. And Forrestal led the campaign behind Truman's back to make sure that our State Department would not permit the State of Israel to be born. In fact, as Harry Truman noted in his diary, he was amazed to wake up and read the newspapers one day and found that the State Department had issued their own decisions on Palestine without even consulting him, after Truman had promised that the opposite result would happen. Forrestal, at the time he was involved with all these machinations, was secretly working on the Dewey campaign to undercut Truman to get him out of office.
Now, Forrestal, of course, was nominally at least a Democrat. Dewey
and a member of Truman's cabinet. And stabbing Truman in the back every chance he could. That's why Truman, after the re-election, forced Forrestal to retire. One of the other reasons, though, was that Forrestal was going mad. He was quite literally insane and committed suicide shortly after he was forced out of office. But just a despicable man.
Something which might be, it's a slight digression, and a digression on my part, and I don't want to linger on it, but I've often wondered in examining far right-wing literature, such as John Birch Society literature, the Rockefellers are accused of being communists and agents of the Zionist conspiracy, which is about as far from the truth as one could possibly get. The Rockefellers are most assuredly not communists, and they most assuredly are not Jews or Zionists or anything else.
Well, I don't think they have any political philosophy. I think it's just simply dollars, either all of us.
Yeah, the thing that I've wondered is, after reading your book, that had always left me scratching my head. And after reading your book, I wonder to what extent that may stem from Rockefeller's having marshaled the votes in the United Nations on behalf of Palestine as a result of that blackmail. Again, it's simply an aside. One of the things that we've already touched on at the very beginning of our interview, John, this is another of the historical threads that winds through the immediate post-World War II period, on up through the Cold War, right on up to the present time. In speaking with about the Vorkommando Moscow, we have already touched on something that to most people would appear to be an oxymoron, if ever there was one, and that is the Fascist Freedom Fighters Program. Could you once again detail that for us, and in particular, the role in that of people like Alan Dulles?
Yeah, the British Secret Service contacted a group of like-minded Americans, Alan Dulles and Forrestal and a few others, to say that we've got to recruit these members of the fascist parties in Eastern Europe. In case World War III breaks out, they'll be our secret army to fight the communists. And, you know, Roosevelt and Truman knew nothing about this. And finally, when Eisenhower came into office, the people who had been bringing the Nazis in and covering it up was suddenly promoted to positions of great power. Alan Dulles became head of CIA, his brother became Secretary of State, and Vice President Nixon became the guy in charge of the Freedom Fighters program. Now, it wasn't until 56, when we had the horrible debacle with the Hungarian uprising, that we really began to realize that these networks that Kim Philby had sold us were just riddled with Soviet agents. We lost nearly 97% of the agents we sent behind the Iron Curtain because these Nazi networks were pipelined directly to Moscow. So it was an enormous political scandal. What do we do with the Nazis in America? Do we investigate them, find out which ones are communists? The whole thing was swept under the rug. Richard Nixon wanted to run for president. And after he lost to Kennedy by 1%, he had a new use for the Nazi ethnic groups. They would be his answer to offset the Jewish vote in the United States.
This gets into an aspect of the importation of some of these Nazi collaborators and war criminals, some of whom were also, that milieu was also penetrated by Soviet intelligence. One thing I've wondered about is also the extent to which there might have been some triple and quadruple agents, some of those also working for German and or American intelligence, but that again remains part of the enigma of the intelligence world. Two other names crop up in connection with the fascist Freedom Fighters program, names familiar to contemporary audiences, those of Ronald Reagan and William Casey, his director of
CIA. Oh, yeah, as I was going through the files in the classified vault, I found that Casey was the intelligence officer assigned in New York to work with the International Rescue Committee. That was the front group that were used to relocate the British intelligence agents, and they could come through without FBI checks. And Casey needed a front group, so he hired a young movie actor named Ronald Reagan to be the public relations man for the Crusade for Freedom. And that's where Americans were supposed to, school kids, send their pennies in to help fund the Freedom Fighters. Well, it turns out that 99% of the funding from the Crusade for Freedom actually came from State Department intelligence accounts. Now, Casey knew that the money was going for the Freedom Fighters project and knew who, certainly these were former fascists. Reagan didn't. He was just a useful front man. But you can imagine my concern. As I was reading these files, Ronald Reagan had just been elected president of the United States, and Bill Casey had just been nominated head of the CIA.
Indeed.
Yeah, that was one of the factors that led me to resign from the Justice Department.
I can understand why. One of the things that I had wondered about in examining the history of involvement between our intelligence agencies and the residue of the Third Reich's intelligence agencies, I had wondered to what extent some of them might actually have been deemed useful for a domestic political standpoint. And indeed, in your book, you and your co-author, Mr. Ahrens, present some very compelling documentation that, in fact, these Third Reich imports were useful not so much as intelligence operatives, because they had their liabilities on both the right and left wing political ends of the political spectrum, but that they were actually employed quite consciously as a domestic political force. I found that shocking and very
important.
It's
the most shocking part of the book, I think. We found a document in Australian intelligence files of a briefing from the Nixon administration in the early 70s saying, in essence, you know, we know where the Nazis are in America, but we're keeping quiet about it because these Eastern European groups are important to get out the ethnic vote in five key states. But the Americans advised the Australians that the Nixon administration was taking precautions. They would, for example, warn selected politicians not to go near the Croatian groups on April 10th, because that was the day they celebrated when Hitler established the Nazi puppet government in Croatia.
Mm-hmm.
There's clearly no doubt they were talking about Nazis. So it's really a very cynical document. We trace the evolution of this. After the Nixon's narrow loss to Kennedy and the defeat of narrow loss of Dewey to Truman, Nixon was determined to mobilize his own bloc. He was convinced that the American Jews had always voted Democratic and were his enemies, so he needed a bloc to offset them. So the Eastern European groups, had, despite their fascist natures, had been dropped overwhelmingly by the U.S. intelligence community. So Nixon recruited their leaders to form an ethnic committee. And he promised that if he won the election in 68 that he would make them a permanent part of the Republican National Committee, and he did. That's where the ethnic heritage section of the Republican National Committee came from. Now, the guy who was in charge of that operation was the chair of the RNC at that time was George Bush.
And you and your authors, your co-author, speculate that one of the things that may very well have laid at the bottom of the Watergate scandal, one of the pieces of submerged truth that might have proved most explosive and the most damaging had it emerged, was this fascist freedom fighter and Republican Ethnic Heritage Council Nazi connection.
Yeah, Nixon was determined to stay in office until George Bush wrote him a letter saying that he had to go. because this would have opened a huge can of worms. And in fact, though, Bush later recruited some of the same people for his campaigns. If you remember, there was a brief scandal in the press where six members of the ethnic outreach section of Bush's campaign were identified as former fascists.
Indeed, it did not get the publicity in 1988. I felt it deserved.
And there was just a handful. And the Republicans have never released the names of the rest of the people on this thing. And we identified several of them. And they were just, you know, former fascists, professional fascists during World War II. They were our enemies during the war.
And they were actually viewed as mobilizers in order to get out the ethnic vote in a number of swing states.
Yeah, the Nazis for Nixon program.
And it was something like five key states were seen as possibly up for grabs, depending on the allegiances of this group, this Nazi element, basically, of the Republican Party. John, we're once again running low on tape here, so I'd like to take a break. And after this break, we will continue this interview. I'm speaking with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the author of The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press. Copyright 1984. We will return with Mr. Loftus after a break.